Well, Van Til's presuppositionalism would not suggest that you depend upon Scripture to find out about barometric pressure or the height of a mountain or the chemical composition of water or what have you. The real issue here, I mean, ultimately, you are right that all the scholastics have the problem that they thought that man's natural reason could operate apart from divine illumination in the direction of Scripture as the unifying interpretive principle of life. You're correct there, but I don't think that it's correct to criticize Bacon's interest in the natural world and the observational approach because he wasn't fully consistent in terms of the ultimate authority of Scripture and everything. Because somebody who does hold that we need the presuppositional truth of God's Word to understand the world properly should still go out and observe the world and pay attention to the details of the creation of God. And what I'm saying is Bacon had that interest. A few moments ago I was saying you have to admire Thomas Aquinas for the project, the grandeur of the project and what he brought about, even though I would be probably one of the strongest critics of Thomas's epistemology and theology and so forth. And all I'm doing here in the same way is saying that I think we need to appreciate as a historical fact and also agree with Roger Bacon's emphasis upon observation, paying attention to the natural world, even though we don't agree with the details of his philosophy. Let me quote a few things from Bacon for you. He says, there are two modes of acquiring knowledge, namely by reasoning and experience. And then a few lines down, he says, reasoning does not suffice, but experience does. I read this for you because this is a different temper, this is a different attitude than you have in the scholastic philosophers who say, if you can prove something by reasoning, that's sufficient. He says, no, you need experience. You need to go out and observe, find out about the world. And in particular, Bacon said we need to develop experiments, I'll get it right. If we would rejoice in the conclusions of our reasoning and not doubt them, then we need to have an experimental approach to the world. He also said that experience is of two kinds, however. There is the experience of the external senses, but he said it's also necessary that one have the experience of man's intellect being aided by illumination within. That may surprise you in light of my discussion just a moment ago with a student here, but you see, the people of the Middle Ages, a good number of the people, I can't, make it universal, but even those who had a faith-reason scheme that was Thomistic and I think objectionable must be understood that they were not secularist. That is what brings the Renaissance about, is when this emphasis upon divine illumination, which is unfortunately an appendage to Roger Bacon's thinking, if you will, finally is just thrown off and said, we don't need divine illumination at all. But he did believe that man's experience was both external and internal if he would know the truth. He does engage in spiritualizing of the results of his experience of the natural world, showing how that brings us closer to God in allegorical ways, he explains, how it's a picture of coming to God and so forth. But there's also bits and pieces in his writings where he goes out to discover the facts, he projects certain hypotheses, and tries to test those hypotheses by observation. Bacon was concerned with the errors that men so commonly make. And he saw four chief obstacles to grasping the truth, he said. One is submission to faulty and unworthy authority. Now, why do I bring that to your attention? Hey, Bacon's no reformer, but you see, he's beginning to say things that are chipping away at something here. You're all relying upon the authority of what? The medieval scholastic theologians, the tradition of the church, and so forth, and he says you can't rely upon faulty tradition. People are influenced by custom, by their prejudices, and often people will conceal their own ignorance. This is not a full-flown spirit of autonomy here. This is something which it seems to me a good biblical Christian should say. People do, in fact, in pride, conceal their ignorance. They are subject to prejudice, so forth and so on. And he said, from these deadly banes come all the evils of the human race. It's because of intellectual pride and obstinance and faulty tradition that people make these mistakes in their reasoning. And let me quote him. One must get understanding from God through the experience of the inner light, I mean in the sacred verities of grace and glory, and stirred through the experience of his senses in the secrets of nature and art, he must discover their reason. Okay, he's still a medieval man because he believes this approach to the world where his senses are stirred is nevertheless the carrying out of the experience of the inner light of God's grace and glory. Knowing God and salvation, knowing the glory of God, he wants to go and experience the world that God has made. Now, according to Bacon, all philosophy that's true philosophy exists, and I'm quoting him, through the influence of divine illumination. God is one and truth is one. So that any man who has truth, any mind that possesses the truth, does so because it has some experience of divine illumination. And for that reason, according to him, the labor of the pagan philosophers, he says, is not opposed to divine wisdom. Okay, this would be a great final exam question for advanced students. I mean, you may clunk along with this as beginners here, but you see, this calls for real sophistication. Is he right or is he wrong about this? He says, the pagans know the truth they do because of divine illumination. And for that reason, what the pagans discover cannot be set opposed to divine wisdom. Well, how is he right? Well, he is right in that it's impossible even for pagans to know things apart from the grace of God. In the history of Reformed thought, we call this common grace. That if God left men to their desired rebellion and autonomy, they would not only destroy themselves eternally, they'd destroy the possibility of knowing anything. And so Bacon is right. The pagans, all truth is one. And so if it's some atheistic, communistic, child-abusing wretch of humanity that discovers the cure for polio, he wasn't, but I'm just using this in illustration, the cure for polio would be just as true and useful, because the truth is one. It's not as though, well, when pagans discover how to cure polio, it won't work for Christians because there's a different truth for Christians. No, the truth is one. And he was correct not only in that we can learn from pagans and gain from what they've learned about the world. He's also correct in saying they're only able to do that by divine illumination. That's his language. We would say common grace. God, enables them to learn these things, which they could not if they were true to their own autonomous and rebellious presuppositions. But then he goes on, that's the good part of what he's saying, but then he goes on to say that we shouldn't think then that the labor of pagan philosophers is opposed to divine wisdom. That is, he completely forgets that there is an antithesis at work there. Why do we call it common grace, whereas he called it divine illumination? Because we want to draw a distinction between the saving grace of God and the common unsaving grace of God, and remember that it's grace that keeps people from being as sinful and rebellious as they would be. And so you should be on your guard against pagan philosophy, I would say. Don't trust what the pagans are saying. That isn't to say they can't say things that are true, but be on your guard, watch out. All truth is one, but not all human nature is one. There are those who are regenerate and those who are unregenerate, and these two, you see, don't get along. They don't see the world the same way. In light of a question that you asked, by the way, Bacon felt that all parts of philosophy, the truth that can be known, even by pagans, was poured into the scriptures. And in that sense, Moses and Solomon had the wisdom of Plato and Aristotle long before Plato and Aristotle did. Okay. The beginning of the Renaissance, seed form Renaissance thinking. Interest in the ancient text, pardon me. Interest in clearing the mind of the fog of tradition and prejudice and so forth, and getting out and learning about this natural world that shows the glory of God. And also an ambiguous, somewhat good but somewhat dangerous affirmation that even the pagans can discover truth. They can, but it's by grace, we would say, and therefore don't take it at their, you know, on their own. Let's come to a second Franciscan. We're still just lecturing in the Middle Ages here, but I want to show another seed of the Renaissance, Duns Scotus. And I will assign the dates 1266 to 1308. So he's in the generation following Bacon and Aquinas. Duns Scotus, by the way, many people had a hard time understanding Duns early in his life. He was a very sophisticated thinker, and he used a very strange and highly technical vocabulary sometimes, and so people made fun of him. And that's where we get our word today, dunce. For somebody to be a dunce is to be like a Duns Scotus. He is Duns Scotus because he came from Scotland, right? Duns, the Scot. He taught at Oxford. The subtlety of his reasoning gave him a reputation that brought him to Paris to teach. And he stood over against the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas on a number of major points. And so you want to see that here is a thinker who is not afraid to challenge the authority of the great medieval philosopher Aquinas. I'm going to look at some details, but let me give you just a generalization to begin with. Thomas Aquinas stressed rationality or reason or intellect. God's primary quality is that of intellect. Man must emphasize his intellect, must know things, use his reason properly. Intellect directs the will. Intellect is the sure guide for life. Intellect is competent. Intellect is like God. Duns Scotus was not an intellectualist. He was intellectual, but he was not an intellectualist. He did not see the intellect as the superior faculty in man. But he said the intellect is itself directed by and under the influence of will or volition. And indeed, God's own character is characterized primarily as power and volition. And that's why Duns Scotus is called a voluntarist in his understanding of the divine nature and also of human nature. Will has a prominent place which even directs reason or intellect. Interestingly, Duns Scotus, though he knew that man's mind was limited at this point in what it could know, and obviously was inferior to the divine mind, he did not believe that man's mind was naturally or essentially limited in what it could know about God. He believed that the mind could have a direct knowledge of God and the truth about universals, about the nature of things. However, because of the fall as a punishment from God, man is no longer able to think directly about the intellectual essences of things or the character of God. Now again, I'm not a follower of Duns Scotus. I don't agree with his theology and most of his philosophical distinctives I would take issue with. But what do you see here? Again, not what you would get in the Renaissance or today. He takes a theological truth and says this has philosophical significance. The fall of man has deprived man of his intellectual ability to directly apprehend the intellectual essence of things or the character of God. This is a punishment that has come upon man, but it is not essential to man's thinking. Now, how is this different from Aquinas? Well, Aquinas had held that anything that men know, they must know through their senses. Even God must be known through man's senses. So there is no direct, unmediated apprehension of God, according to Aquinas. Aquinas was very empirical. There's nothing in the intellect that is not first in the senses. Whereas for Duns Scotus, there can be something that's in the intellect that is not mediated by the senses. You can directly know the forms or essences of things, and you can directly know God, except man has now fallen into sin, and it's because of sin that man is now tied to sensation and knowing things through observation. In the Middle Ages, there was a debate over how anything can be said of God that's literally true, because God is not really like man. God is distant from and different from man. So whenever we say things of God, we seem to be using terms in different ways. When I say, that's the door through which I will leave to go to lunch, and I say, and Jesus is the door through which I will enter heaven, I'm using the word door in both of those sentences, but no one thinks I'm using them in literally the same way, right? Now, to use door in two different ways like this is to speak equivocally, okay? To speak equivocally, because I'm using the term in different ways. If I meant that Jesus was literally a door that you swing open and you can enter into heaven, I would be using the term in a univocal way. Now, the question arises, can we say anything univocally about God, or is everything we say equivocal? Are we always saying things about God that have a meaning different when applied to this world than when we use the term in application to God or our relationship to God. According to Duns Scotus, if the way we speak of God is equivocal, then we could never have any true knowledge of God. Consequently, he argued, the being of God and the being of man are univocal. The being of God and the being of man are univocal. And here, my dear friends, we have one of the greatest heresies, philosophical mistakes, that anyone can make. In fact, Dr. Van Til would teach us that this is at the heart of all unbelieving thought, although Duns Scotus was attempting to write as a Christian, and that is the idea that the creator-creature distinction is not fundamental. God's being, the way in which God exists, the nature of his existence, is different from the nature of man's. The creator-creature distinction is compromised when Duns Scotus says God exists, when we say God exists and man exists, we're using exist in the same way. We're using the term univocally rather than equivocally. Now, does that mean that he is a pantheist, that God and man are really the same kind of being? Well, of course, Duns Scotus did not accept pantheism. He said God's being and man's being are the same in the sense that they're opposed to nothingness. When I say that God exists and man exists, I'm saying of both of them that they are not nothing. Moreover, he thought that the essential nature of man is indissolubly joined to the existence of man, and that that was true of God too, that God's nature, his essence, to use the philosophical term, is inseparable from his existence. It's not as though you can have a lot of different kinds of gods. God exists, and this essence is necessary to God. Man exists, and this essence is necessary to man. However, Duns Scotus introduced a new kind of distinction, and this is one of the reasons he was thought to be a dunce, because people didn't draw the fine distinctions that he would. And this is a characteristic of later philosophy. Duns was interested in doing what we call analysis, looking at terms and how they are used and drawing fine distinctions. Duns said that there is a difference between the existence of God and the existence of man, but it's not a real distinction that would make it equivocal, nor is it merely a subjective, in that day it would be called a rational distinction, something imposed by the reasoning of man's mind. He said it's a distinction that is discerned by the mind, but is objectively there. And this he called a formal distinction. There's a formal distinction between God and man, in that you can think of man's essence and existence as separated, but you can't even think of God's existence and essence as separated. The nature of God and the existence of God cannot even be thought of apart from one another. Now, man, though it is true that his nature and his existence cannot be separated, you could at least think of them as separated. But you can't think of them as separated when it comes to God. Let's go on to another issue in the thinking of Duns Scotus. We ask the question whether you can know the objects of the natural world without divine illumination. He asked this question, I quote him, whether any sure and pure truth can be known naturally by the understanding of the wayfarer without the special illumination of the uncreated light, a reference to God, the uncreated light. Is divine illumination necessary to know the things of this world? It had been the history of the Franciscans, thinkers in that order, following Augustine, to say that if you deny divine illumination, you will be led to skepticism. The idea that you can know something in the natural world without divine illumination leads ultimately to the idea that you can't know anything at all, to skepticism. And Duns Scotus disagreed with that. And he disagreed with it, believe it or not, he disproved it by quoting one verse of the Bible. And he said, that settles it. Because you all know that what the Bible says is true. Again, you see how he's not a Renaissance man. He may not be, you know, presuppositionally pure. He may not be reformed in his outlook. But again, he's closer to us than he is to the secularist, in that he would go to the Bible and say, this settles it. And the one verse that he quoted was from Romans chapter 1. Ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature has been clearly seen through what he has made. So Dunn says, apparently you can know things apart from divine illumination, because the Bible says that everyone knows God through the things that he has made. Well, class, what's good about this and what's bad about this? What's good about this is that he assumes the truth of Scripture and it informs his philosophical reasoning. What's bad is he has not interpreted Scripture correctly. Because Paul not only says that these things are clearly seen through the created order, Paul says, and all men suppress that truth in unrighteousness. So that there is a natural ability to understand God's world. And that technical, formal sense, Duns Scotus is right. There's a natural ability that men have. But in their fallen condition, that natural ability doesn't profit them anything because they always suppress it, refuse to see it for what it is. They refuse to see the glory of God in the world around them that they experience. We move on to another matter in the philosophy of Duns Scotus that shows his difference from Thomas Aquinas. We have to consider his principle of individuation. Now, if you were not in the ancient and medieval course, then this question of the principle of individuation will probably be pretty senseless to you. What is that all about? Well, what is it that makes all of you students the same? Is there anything? Are you different in every respect? Well, if you were, we wouldn't call you students, would we? You're all students in a common way. There are certain things that you have in common that set you apart from one another as students, I mean, set you as a group apart from other individuals who are not students. And yet, you're not all the same student. Some of you will turn in your timelines on time. Some of you won't. Okay, some of you have certain thoughts, others not. Some have certain study habits, others. You're not all the same. So what individuates you as students? In terms of the universal that we're all part of, be it humanity or being students or whatever, the question comes up, now that you understand how to unify all the particulars, these are all human beings, or these are all students, or what have you, how do we protect our individuality? What sets one student over against another? Or let's think of the old medieval question that people make fun of, and they show their ignorance by making fun of it. We ask, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? The way in which a person answers that question shows what his view of individuation is. Because if you believe that matter is what individuates things, why is it that Huey, Dewey, and Louie out on the pond are considered three different ducks? It's because there's a different, they're all ducks. So they have the same form or universal, but they have different matter in them. If that's your answer, matter individuates things that are all part of the universal, then obviously only one angel can dance on the head of a pin. Because if you had two, the matter would prevent both from being on the head of the pin. If, on the other hand, you believe that there's another or a rational principle that individuates things that are members of a class, then an infinite number of angels could dance on the head of the pin. And so you see that old question that most people look at and say, well, who cares about angels and pins and blah, 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 misses the whole point. It's just a clever way of finding out whether this person thinks that matter individuates things. Now, what was Duns Scotus's answer to this principle of individuation? What sets things apart from each other that are all part of a general class? Thomas thought that matter individuated things. Thomas, being an Aristotelian, also held that matter is unknowable. The only thing you can know must have form, and therefore matter, the pure principle of matter apart from form, is ultimately unknowable. Now, let's be philosophical here. Put all this together. If matter separates the different members of a class, and matter is unknowable because it doesn't have form to it, then individuality is unknowable. Because it's matter, something which is unknowable, that individuates things. And so individuality would be on knowledge. And so Duns Scotus didn't agree with Thomas on this matter. If matter individuates, we cannot know things in their particularity. We can only know them in their general qualities. We can know their generic characteristics, but never their particular individual characteristics. How would you like that? You know, you're going to call somebody up for a date, and it turns out it makes no difference which girl you ask, because all girls are the same. You know? You don't have, Sherry and Ruth and Linda and so forth. What you have here is generic woman. And that wouldn't be very good, would it? We want to be able to say we know the differences between Sherry and Ruth and Linda. But according to Duns Scotus, Thomas makes that impossible. You can't know but the generic qualities. You can't know the individual differences. And so Duns Scotus had a very different approach to individuation. According to him, there is a distinct form for every individual that exists. So let's go back to Sherry and Ruth and Linda. Not only do Sherry, Ruth, and Linda share humanity and femaleness, that is, they have the form of femininity, okay? Not only do they have that, but Sherry has the form of Sherriness, and Linda has the form of Lindaness. Ruth has the form of Ruthness. So they have certain things in common, the form of humanity, the form of femininity, but they have certain forms they don't share, the forms that refer to their individual characteristics. Or Duns Scotus put it this way, the form of femininity or of humanity is contracted differently in Sherry, contracted differently in Ruth, contracted differently in Linda. Where the universal of humanity or the universal of femininity can be divided into parts, the universal of Sherriness or Lindaness cannot be divided into parts. And so when you get that kind of universal that is not divisible, he said, you've reached the end of the process of logical division and you have a thisness, the Latin expression. I'll spell it for you, H-A-E-C-C-E-I-T-A-S, a thisness. Hexatus, a thisness. This sets him over against Aquinas. And though it is a very interesting idea, I for one believe that it's a confused and ultimately ridiculous idea, because there is nothing universal about Lindenus. There's nothing universal about the thisness of this particular person. And even if you don't understand that particular conflict, that to speak of the individual defining characteristics as themselves generic or universal qualities, even though they aren't, the problem is that nothing, when we try to account for the particulars of our experience and we organize things into classes or into universals, if it turns out that there's a universal for everything, then the realm of universals turns out to be nothing more but a mirror image of the world we're trying to explain, and therefore it hasn't explained anything. These are difficult ideas, especially if you haven't studied Plato and Aristotle and all the rest, but let me put it to you this way. If it turns out that everything that I see in this world has its corresponding universal, including the particularities of time and space, personality, and all the rest, then there's the same number of things in my level of explanation as there are things that are being explained. Which is to say, I'm not explaining anything. I haven't reduced the diversity to anything. I've just reproduced the diversity at another level called intellectual essences. And so I don't think that Duns Scotus here can be credited with doing anything. Well, he's a clever fellow, you know? And this is an interesting way of approaching it, but I just don't think it's going to work. Why have I taught you all this? I can see you're all saying, when are we going to get to lunch? What's this all about? I want you to see that Duns Scotus did not fear to challenge, in terms of his approach to philosophy, the orthodox approach, that is that which was now orthodox, the approach of Thomas Aquinas. The most important difference between he and Aquinas is seen, however, and the fact that Duns Scotus exalted the primacy of the will in God and man, whereas Thomas Aquinas exalted the intellect. And I think Duns Scotus must be credited here for being closer to the truth than Aquinas. Aquinas would say, and by the way, there are Protestants of the 20th century who would say the same sort of thing, that the intellect of man is primary. Because it's the intellect, after all, that informs the emotions and the will. If you didn't think about something, if you didn't understand this is a taco, that's a burrito, so that you can choose the taco over the burrito or vice versa, then, you know, the will wouldn't be informed or guided at all. But Duns Scotus was, I think, again, more subtle and here more correct than Aquinas, in that he said, but the will determines what is relevant for the intellect to study. It isn't as though we walk through this world just like, you know, open receptors of everything in the world round about us. Have you ever noticed that? There's such a thing known as attention. We pay attention. That's an English expression. We focus. That's what you're having trouble doing right now if you don't like this abstraction in philosophy. It's going to get easier, trust me. But nevertheless, there is this process of choosing to think about something. When you have to force yourself to do your geometry homework, is it your intellect here that's primary or your will? Yeah, okay, that gets the point across. Will the will do the homework? No. You can't answer geometry questions without intellect. You have to use your reasoning. But the point is, you won't use your intellect for this unless the will chooses that the intellect do this. Moreover, there are things about you in terms of your willing and choosing that get in the way of intellect too. Sometimes we desire a conclusion so much that our intellect is led in that direction. It's what you call rationalization. Okay? We look at the evidence in a certain way because we have chosen a certain conclusion as our outcome. And so Duns Scotus, being a voluntarist, I think, has seen something that's very important that Thomas Aquinas, being an intellectualist, did not. But you see, there's a downside to this too. If you're a voluntarist, and especially if you think this is true of God's character, that God's sovereignty, I mean, you can make this sound very pious. Duns Scotus preached the sovereignty of God. God's will is supreme, he said. God can do anything he wishes. He's not bound by anything. Well, then the question arises, if God's will is the primary thing, then can God change his mind about what he thinks? And so the question arises in medieval thought, could God send the Virgin Mary to hell? Now, from what God's intellect has revealed, Mary's going to heaven. But could God choose to go contrary to it? The voluntarist has to protect the sovereignty of God and say, yes, God could even do that. Whereas the followers of Aquinas would say, absolutely not. God cannot send the Virgin Mary to hell. So you see, that nicely illustrates, like the angels on the head of the pin, that nicely illustrates whether you're a voluntarist or an intellectualist. I think Reformed theology has an answer that doesn't fall into either one of those problems, and it's basically God's covenantal character. God is bound by his own character. And so what he chooses to do will always be in line with his intellect, what is true about him and what he has revealed. Anyway, with respect to God's moral will, Duns Scotus said God could have done things differently, God could change his mind, but he cannot change his mind about the Ten Commandments. Okay, I'm glad that bothers you. You say, well, isn't that just a little arbitrary? It may be mistaken, but it's not arbitrary, and for this reason. Duns Scotus said every one of the Ten Commandments is actually a working out of the law of non-contradiction. I think that's highly artificial. I think that's easy to refute, easy to ridicule. But though he may be wrong in the program, the outworking of it, you need to know that according to him, there is one thing God cannot do, and that is God cannot contradict himself. And if God ordered murder rather than forbidding murder, he would be violating the law of contradiction. And so, in that sense, the Ten Commandments are not arbitrary. They are not the whims of God's will, because it would be contrary. Even God cannot contradict himself. And the last thing about Duns Scotus, and this is very important in terms of his being part of the seeds of the Renaissance, Duns Scotus felt there were great limitations to natural theology. Great limitations to natural theology. Aquinas, of course, had a very robust confidence in natural theology. Man's reasoning ability, even the unregenerate man's natural reasoning ability, can find out much about God. That God exists, that God is eternal, that God is intellectual, that he's provident, that he's good. These sorts of things can all be discovered by the natural theological reasoning of man, according to Thomas Aquinas. Now, Duns Scotus agreed that man's natural reason can discover some truths about God, But he believed that because of Adam's fall, this capacity is much less than what Thomas Aquinas thought. Because of the fall of man, natural theology is not able to accomplish what Thomas Aquinas felt that it could. In particular, Duns Scotus thought that Thomas Aquinas' argument for God as the unmoved mover was ridiculous. He said, that doesn't prove the existence of God at all. And he was a better philosopher here than Aquinas. Let me give you Aquinas' argument and then a couple of the problems with it. All right, so real quickly, Thomas Aquinas proves, or thinks that he proves, that there's a God because there's motion in this world. Now, anything that's moved must itself be moved. Anything that's moving was moved by something else. Motion is an effect which has to have a cause. Thomas Aquinas says, so there must be a first mover that is itself unmoved. Because if the first mover had to be moved, it wouldn't be first. And that's what we call God. Duns Scotus says, excuse me? Can we go over this again? Have you proven that there is a first mover? Have you proven that there are a multitude of first movers? You haven't proven that there's a God. You've proven that there might be an infinite number of first movers. There's the first mover of peach trees and the first mover of automobiles and the first mover of oceans and waves and so forth. And for all we know, these things are not all tied together into one single one. And beyond that, why must there be a first mover? And the answer is because if you don't have a first mover, you have an infinite regress. And therefore, you haven't explained anything. Duns Scotus said, what makes you think an infinite regress doesn't explain anything? It explains things in terms of the framework, every framework that you want explained. Then you move it back. Somebody wants to know, where does it all begin? The answer is, that's a misguided desire for profundity. It doesn't begin anywhere. It just keeps going back. This whole question of infinite regress proves to be much more psychological than it turns out to be logical. Now, of course, you would expect that sort of analysis from Duns Scotus, wouldn't you? Because his emphasis in man is upon what? Volition, rather than upon intellect. But nevertheless, he didn't find Thomas Aquinas' argument here to be very good. He did think other arguments, especially the argument from contingent being to necessary being, he thought that was a much better argument. However, it doesn't prove that God is one, nor does it prove that he is good or that he's perfect. It doesn't prove that he's omnipotent, that he's providential. And so, even where Duns Scotus would say there's limited success in what Thomas Aquinas did, it is a very limited success. The scope of natural theology is therefore greatly lessened in Duns Scotus. Well, then, how do we learn about God? Duns Scotus said we learn about God through revelation, not through proof. Now, some of you out there who have studied apologetics say, well, that sounds pretty good. Well, it all depends on what lies behind this assertion. Think about this. We learn about God through revelation, not through proof. What he's doing here is separating a realm where proof is possible from a realm where you need revelation. This is not Augustinian. And what he's doing here, and this is why we see the seeds of the Renaissance, what he's doing here, basically, is saying that man's reason can exercise all right over here in the realm of proof, and that doesn't go very far theologically. That is, he is rather than making reason based upon faith, which is the Augustinian approach, which is where I'd like to see him move, he essentially starts separating reason and faith into different categories. And his successor, Occam, is going to do that explicitly. We're not up to Immanuel Kant yet. We got a few centuries to get in there.
It just seems like you see the development of it, you know, the dialecticalism of it.
Right. Oh, I agree with you. And you'll see when I finally get the Renaissance pattern up on the board that Kant's phenomenal noumenal fact value distinction is based in the Renaissance, which had its seeds in medieval philosophy. So I appreciate you projecting down the line and seeing that, but most of you won't understand what we've been talking about. So we'll do this in an evolutionary way and develop it. William of Ockham, 1285 to 1349. I will just abbreviate him to Occam. It's William of Occam, O-C-C-A-M or O-C-K-H-A-M sometimes, Occam. He too was a Franciscan, studied at Oxford, later moved to Paris. Seems to be a pattern for these guys, huh? Occam got into an argument with the Pope over how the Franciscan vow of poverty was to be understood. Occam was a rigorist. He thought it should be taken literally. The Pope didn't. He disputed the point. He was anxious to go to Rome and argue. So the Pope excommunicated him in 1328. And he took refuge with the Emperor Louis of Bavaria. Sound familiar? Pope excommunicates somebody, that theologian takes refuge with a political sovereign or protector. Okay, this pattern, which we see in the life of Martin Luther and others, you see, is already beginning to develop, where the Pope has this great power, but Louis of Bavaria can offer at least temporary support and protection to somebody who disagrees with the Pope. Occam emphasized the simplicity of those theories which are truth. You have in the case of Bacon an emphasis upon the utility of knowledge. We need to get out and experience the world because it's useful. Occam says we need to get out and learn about the world because we can come to more simple explanations of what happens than you get in all this scholastic and Aristotelian rational explanation of why things take place. Duns Scotus, I told you a moment ago, had been narrowing the domain of natural theology. Scotus said, Aquinas can prove certain things about God, but not as much as he thought. Occam went even further. He said you can prove hardly anything at all by natural reason. In fact, you cannot prove his existence, his unity, or his infinity. To be honest, said Occam, the spheres of faith and reason are so distinct that the conclusions drawn in one area may actually contradict the conclusions drawn in another. Okay, so if we look at Aquinas, let me draw an arrow down here on the board, you have the idea that man's reason operates self-sufficiently and can prove a great number of things about God, and then that is perfected by adding to it what we know by faith. So faith becomes, you know, that which is placed on the fundamental foundation of reason. In Occam, you have faith totally separated from reason. Now, why do I think there's a connection between these two? Obviously, there's great disagreements between Occam and Thomas. Occam doesn't think you can prove things by natural reason that about God that Thomas Aquinas thought. But you see, what Thomas Aquinas had done is he set reason off as naturally self-sufficient. Reason doesn't need faith or divine grace to arrive at certain truths. Not all of them, but certain truths about God. And to that degree, then, reason is somewhat autonomous, isn't it? It's independent of faith. Though Occam came to disagree with Aquinas, in one sense, he agreed entirely with Aquinas and actually took Aquinas further by saying, yes, reason is self-sufficient, completely self-sufficient. It's not in the same ballpark. It doesn't touch faith at all. So you have two different realms, two different spheres. The sphere of natural reason and the sphere of faith. Now, when in your natural reason you draw a conclusion which is contrary to what you draw in the realm of faith, he said there's no problem because they are so separate that they can't contradict each other. That is to say, you have to just allow that apparent contradiction to stand. It may seem irrational to do what the theologians of faith tell you. That is, it doesn't fit in with what reason would tell you, but you follow it anyway because you're a good Christian. Your piety leads you to do even irrational things because faith is not tied to reason at all. In fact, reason is irrelevant to faith. Now, aren't you glad that in the 20th century, the church doesn't have anybody who would affirm things like that, that we've gotten beyond that idea? Aren't you glad that no one in the Christian church today promotes the idea that faith can be completely irrational? And of course, I'm being facetious with you. You know that unfortunately that idea still is with us to this day, that faith and reason are to be totally separated. Now, what happens, even in our own day, when you have Christian groups that say, faith is over here and my reasoning ability is over here? Are they then willing to let their reasoning ability and all that they do be controlled by the Bible so that everything is done to the glory of God? No. When you do this, of necessity, you are going to create a secular-sacred dichotomy. So the man's reason, even though many fundamentalist and anti-intellectual pietistic churches may not send their kids off to college and so forth, the point is, when you've been brought up in that tradition, if you do anything with your intellect, there's no thought about that having to be brought into connection with what you do on Sunday. Piety has nothing to do with reasoning. And this all goes back to, well, I mean, there's a lot of different influences, but you see that in William of Ockham. We don't have to worry about faith and reason conflicting with each other. They don't have anything to do with each other, according to him. Remember the voluntarism of Duns Scotus? On that basis, God can do anything. God is omnipotent. He can literally do anything. Occam said, since everything God does is, in a sense, according to his whim, it's arbitrary, rather than based on some rational plan, or as Reformed theologians say, according to his covenanted purposes, then it's ridiculous to try to understand what God has done. Okay? Here's a great mystery. God has become incarnate. He's taken on human form. Should we try to understand that? Occam said, can't understand it, because it's based on God's will. And God's will is not controlled by a rational plan, by his intellect or his reason. Therefore, you just accept it on faith and you go on. How about understanding this world? Should we bring God into the matter of understanding this world? I want to understand what happens when I put salt in water. Now, I might go out and study the world and try to bring God into the picture. I put salt in water and it dissolves, and I do it again, and it dissolves, and so forth. And I think I'm learning something about the uniformity of the natural world. But since God is omnipotent and voluntaristically so, then for all I know, God is intervening every time and creating a miracle. That it's not really that salt dissolves in water. It wouldn't dissolve in water if it weren't for the miraculous intervention of God. You say, why would God do that? Because God is sovereign. He can do anything he wants. Now, that approach to the natural world would make science impossible, wouldn't it? If you have the idea that you can't count on or make predictable the things that you're seeing in the world around about you because God arbitrarily and sovereignly intervenes doing these miracles and you're not aware that they're miracles, then why bother to study the natural world? And so Occam would have led to a virtual skepticism about knowing anything in the natural world. And one of his students, Nicholas of Authrecourt, actually drew these skeptical conclusions. He said, we can't be aware of anything except for our immediate sensations. We can't draw any connections between our sensations. We can't believe in causality. We can't even believe in personal identity over time. Because we don't see causality. We don't see personal identity over time. We just have momentary sensations. So here's one student of Occam who took it to its logical conclusion. He says, you can't know anything about the natural world. And yet Occam did believe that people could know things about the natural world. And why is that? Because the natural world is known by reason, not by faith. If we allowed these faith principles, God's sovereignty, the possibility of miracles and what have you, to enter into our reasoning about the natural world, then it would destroy the possibility of knowing anything. Whoa! Isn't that a terrible reversal of Vantillian thought? Dr. Van Til says, if we don't bring faith into the question, reason can't learn anything. Occam's argument was, if you bring faith into the picture, then reason can't rely on anything. And that's because Occam was a voluntarist. Because God was not reliable, in a sense. Well, then what was his theory of knowledge? I mean, I'm not sure that we need to go into everything. In terms of the doctrine of universals, Occam believed, he had a very complicated theory of the use of terms. And he said a universal is basically a convenient summary for all the individuals in a class. So when I speak of man, I'm just speaking of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and everybody without having to name them all. It's just a summary expression. But there is a sign, a natural sign in the mind. When I look at individual men, there is a cognitive or psychological process that gives me the term man. The way I use the term is just as a summary for the individuals. So he said the problem of universals is not a problem at all. By the way, this just goes to show how little sometimes people appreciate the difficulty of the problem of universals. He says the term, a universal like noun, just applies to all the individual nouns that we're talking about. It's a summary expression. Man applies to all the individual men. Cow to all the cows you've met, and so forth. Well, in that sense, he could have been thought of as a nominalist, because that's the nominalist answer. The difference is, Occam believed that there was a natural, not an arbitrary, but a natural sign or term in the mind, man, that comes to our thought when we experience the individual men. Well, then I have to ask this question. I'm being critical now of Occam. He doesn't answer the problem of universals, I don't think. And that is the thinking act that is taking place at this particular moment where I'm thinking of Pete, is this act of thinking of Pete that took place 5 seconds ago the same act of thinking of Pete that's taking place right now, 15 seconds later? Well, if it is the same, then there's something other than the individual psychological process, isn't there? And that just reintroduces the problem of universals all over again. Occam hasn't solved the problem of universals. He's just transferred the problem from how can there be classes separate from the individuals to how can there be the same kind of thinking process of an individual at different times and places. So we still have the one and the many problem. It's just what the one and when, what the one and many are all about. What Occam is most known for is the idea that when you have, the way he solved the problem of universals, he said, I have a simple explanation of universals. The way I explain the use of the term manness or humanity, it doesn't require the postulation of an entity like a Platonic form known as man. And according to Occam, that explanation, which is the simplest, ought to be the one that is preferred. I wanted to read the famous expression of Occam's razor. He says, do not multiply entities beyond necessity. That is, if you have two ways of accounting for something, prefer that account which is the simpler of the two. Since he believed his account of universals was simpler than the other schools of philosophy of his day, then he thought that set forth his view as superior. Now this makes Occam in a twofold way a forerunner of the Renaissance. First of all, he's a forerunner of the Renaissance because he wanted reason to be totally separated from faith. Totally. You don't have to worry about faith intervening. In fact, if faith does intervene in our attempt to understand the natural world, then it destroys our ability to know anything. So he really got these set over against one another. They may even contradict each other, but you just have to accept both. And so he anticipates the Renaissance in the extreme autonomy of reason that he grants. And secondly, he anticipates the Renaissance emphasis upon scientific explanation as that which is the simpler of the hypotheses that are offered. Where Roger Bacon said knowledge is characterized by utility, usefulness, Occam said knowledge is characterized by simplicity of explanation. And that will be part of the Renaissance scientific ideal. Okay, one more note and we'll be done with the Middle Ages here. Occam separates faith and reason to watertight compartments. Don't have to worry about contradictions between them. They have nothing to do with each other. This is part of a tradition in medieval philosophy associated with Islamic and Aristotelian studies The name Averroes ought to be in your notes somewhere. Averroes. Arabian scholar who lived from 1126 to 1198. Averroes, Averroes. Averroes, in a sense, went even further than Duns Scotus and Ockham in separating theology and philosophy. Averroes explicitly set forth the doctrine of double truth. There is one truth in philosophy, there's another truth in theology. And the outcome of that approach to matters was to completely secularize science and philosophy. Theology or religion has nothing to do with science and philosophy. And so what I want you to see is that at the end of the Middle Ages, as we've finished now our whirlwind tour of ancient and medieval philosophy, at the end of the Middle Ages, there is a great emphasis on the idea that you put theology or religion over here in one compartment, and you put science and philosophy or the natural reason of man in a different compartment altogether. And we don't have to worry about approaching this world with theological presuppositions or even the influence of theological thinking, because man's natural reason has nothing to do with theology. And it's in that seed of autonomy that we see the Renaissance growing up, the reassertion of the man-centeredness and autonomy of the classic Greek world and the philosophers Plato and Aristotle. And we come back together tomorrow. We'll continue our lectures, now beginning to look at the Renaissance itself in this blurry period where the Middle Ages is dying out and the Renaissance is starting up.